Now, I've been teaching on the pyramid, reading primarily the last couple of weeks from Adam Rutherford, his four-volume series entitled Pyramidology. One thing should be coming through clear. Move that thing that way. Yeah. One thing should be coming through clear. By the way, Robin Williams didn't have a cigar. He didn't do his research all the way. Even Bill Cosby, when he did his Las Vegas act on cigar smokers, included me in that. And my freedom stick. Don't leave that out if you're going to do a presentation of me. Your brain will never be warm enough to handle the subject. One thing should be clear. What tradition has told us about the development of man from rather stupid and primitive to the present age is just a crock. There was a real smart source of information that planned the pyramid, lined it up to true north, clearly understood the earth was a sphere, the dimensions of the earth, the exact distance from the north to the south pole, which we can calculate now with satellites, the distance from the earth to the sun, the 3 years determined by the heavenly bodies, the solar, the sidereal, and the anomalistic, the precession of the equinoxes. Now, the engineering skill is a marvel, but the astronomical knowledge required a source of knowledge that we have not, in tradition, credited to the ancient cultures. Now, as we've said several times, Josephus in the first century said that the descendants of Seth, and it seems sort of incongruous to say the descendants of Seth, unless you're antediluvian, pre-flood. Otherwise, you talk about the descendants of Noah or one of his sons, all of whom were descendants of Seth. So it doesn't make much sense to reference the descendants of Seth, plus the fact, anticipating from a prophecy of Adam, that the earth would be destroyed both by flood and fire, water and fire, built a place to perpetuate and store their knowledge, a kind of time capsule, twice. One of brick near Mesopotamia, one of stone, which in the first century AD, when Josephus was writing, he said was still standing in Egypt in his day. That could only be the pyramid. And it was to preserve a knowledge. Now we move from the packaging of the pyramid, the wondrous astronomical knowledge contained therein, and mathematical knowledge contained therein, built upon pi, for example, to the interior passages. Are amazed at the perfect alignment that occurred once in the some 25 to 26,000 year precession of the equinoxes, when the plane of the dragon constellation, particularly the star Thuban, and the strongest star, Alpha Draconis, was perfectly aligned until it would shine down the descending passage of the pyramid, and the scored lines put there to mark a benchmark perfectly aligned with the pyramids, that happens once, 2441 B.C. The measuring unit of the pyramid being 1/500,000,000, now we're going to go through this again tonight. It's either too cold or too hot. Too cold now. 1/500,000,000th of the distance from the north to the south pole through the center of the earth, those inches marked off from the benchmark portray the downward course of mankind under the influence of the dragon, Satan, perfectly marking the upward turn, God's interference with Satan's control, the exodus out of Egypt, perfectly marking the birth plus the death and resurrection of Christ, and many more significant historic dates in the history of mankind and this earth. Somebody real smart knew something. Now, it will appear tonight that I'm going to shift from the pyramid for a minute. I'm not. I will give evidence further down as we attempt to prove what I believe is the case, that the pyramid was built long before the reign of Cheops. And that Cheops or Khufu, depending on whether you use his Greek or Egyptian name, identified with the pyramid, but he didn't build it. And as we've said, which is obvious, it never was a place of burial, and his body was buried elsewhere. Later in this series, to show the antiquity of the pyramid beyond Khufu, I'm going to show you from records an ancient summer in Akkadia, perhaps based on present archaeology, the oldest civilizations ever to exist. That they had knowledge of the pyramid in Egypt. Still too cold. And if they had knowledge of the pyramid in Egypt, and they existed long before Cheops, doubtful he built it. Turn that thing off for a minute. I'm going to sneeze. God, I wish we could hire the builders of the pyramid to work on this air conditioning system in here. Now, as part of that process, and to get us ready for proving the more ancient date and a possible demonstration of Enoch's building of the pyramid before the flood of the line of Seth, thus making Josephus' statement accurate, I want to read from one of the most far-out authors that's written in recent generations. He's got some wild ideas. But like Velikovsky, he does some of the most thorough research, the product of 30, 40 years research, that you'll find anywhere. I'm talking about Zachariah Sitkin. He has written 3 books. He calls them the Earth Chronicles. The first one was The 12th Planet. You all go out and empty the bookstores of it now. The second was The Stairway to Heaven. You'll remember that because it was in The Stairway to Heaven and we spent about a week on it, that he gave the convincing proof and evidence that Colonel Vice forged the cartouche of Cheops, which has been used to prove that it was built during Cheops' reign. Vice was a forger. The third book he has written, The Wars of Gods and Men. An interesting little, if I marked it, there's an interesting little comment in it. I think I didn't mark it. But anyway, after his book was published, proving Vice a forger, a member of the family of one who had worked with Vice and gave evidence of his forgery and was fired and banned from the site, not allowed to work, came forward to give further evidence of Vice's forgery. I'll get to that when we talk about the knowledge of the pyramid among the Sumerians. He's got four odd theories, but his research is impeccable. And as in The Stairway to Heaven, we read that section. And you can buy the book if you want. Some of you did, but it ain't going to do much for you. Because I take the research from the book and fit it into what we're doing. Whereas he takes that research and makes it support his four-out theory. Of beings from outer space who came to this earth and populated it and brought this knowledge and helped start the mess, which we are. Now, before you reject that utterly, beings from outer space, if this earth is considered space and anything out there is outer, certainly are suggestive of the Bible. I mean, angels didn't come out of gopher holes. Is this going to be the Tuesday night crowd? You change crowds on me? You look like I'm boring you and I haven't even started. Give me a break. I get good at boring a little later. How could anybody do a legitimate impression of me without a cigar? And it is very clear in the book of Genesis that the sons of God came down from somewhere and saw the women on this earth and mated with them, produced giants, and created problems. Where do they come from? They didn't come from gopher holes. And Elijah took off in a chariot of fire. And an angel came down and killed a whole mess of soldiers under Sennacherib. And God himself came down and talked to Moses on Mount Sinai. But we have this special set of spiritual gears we put in our head. That when the Bible's talking about it, it's some kind of mixture. Well, it happened, but it really didn't happen. I mean, you know, don't bother me with the details. Where was God before he landed on Mount Sinai? And where did he go when he left? Don't give me this business of, you know, going into some dimension and coming back through it. And that would suffice as outer space. They were here and then they weren't. And they weren't and then they were here. And it's very clear in Genesis, God came down in the cool of the evening and talked. Indeed, the original is God's. Elohim, in the plural. Came down in the cool of the evening, walked and talked with Adam and Eve. And when they messed up and were hiding because of their nakedness, he killed an animal and skinned it, gave them animal skin clothing. Now, who were those guys that came and talked to Abraham on the way to annihilating Sodom and Gomorrah? And where were they before they got there, and where'd they go after they got the burning job done? I mean, you know, heavenly pyromaniacs. Well, you don't look at the Bible like that. You know, you just, they're there when the chapter comes along and the verse comes along, and then they're gone. So, you know, these four-out theories aren't much more four-out than the Bible. I believe the Bible. So I'm not against supernatural beings from outer space having contact with Earth. My Lord God of mercy. You ain't ever seen a UFO match the one Ezekiel saw. And what about that angel that came and fought the princes of Persia and delivered his message to Daniel? And he went back, the prince of Persia was no more, lo, the prince of Grecia comes. And he talks about wars, where Michael stood with him once, or he stood with Michael once, now Michael's standing with him. And there's sure as hell going to be an invasion from outer space when I come back with Jesus in the Armageddon. That's when I'll understand it all. And you, I hope. Evangelical fundamentalism, as he's been expecting for a long time, rapture of the church, meeting in the air, and away you go, where? And don't talk to me about up, you know. If you're on the wrong side of the globe when the rapture takes place, you're going to bore through it or sail around it. And they all come back with Jesus. Jacob had a vision of a ladder. Heaven and the earth. Well, he said, that's a vision, yeah. But it's no wilder than the accounts of that which is not visionary. So even though this guy's got some four-out ideas, he's not crazy. And his research is impeccable. Let us review the history of our own knowledge of Earth and the heavens around it, since we're the smart 20th century generation. I'm not departing from the pyramid. The knowledge that the pyramid builders had, so superior to anybody today, was not unique to that little spot in Egypt. And let me show it to you by reviewing the history of our own knowledge of the earth and the heavens around it, and then check it against something else. We know today that beyond the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, at distances, I'm reading from the 12th planet, the first of this trilogy, book one of the Earth Chronicles. We know today that beyond the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, at distances insignificant in terms of the universe, but immense in human terms, two more major planets, Uranus and Neptune. I'm smiling because I had a luncheon with some very prominent people and with some scientists, Nobel Prize winners from Mount Wilson Observatory. And one distinguished guest at the table didn't hear very well. And he was not primarily a scientist. He was an attorney. And one of the Nobel Prize winners wanted to start a conversation at his end of the table on that which he was a specialist in. And the space probe had just gone past Uranus. Looked around at this guy and said, "What do you think of Uranus?" And you can imagine the response of the hard of hearing. No, I'm not going to tell you. We know today that beyond the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn, two more major planets, Uranus and Neptune, and a third small one, Pluto, belong to our solar system. But such knowledge, like pi, for example, in mathematics, such knowledge is quite recent, considering the history of man. Uranus was discovered through the use of improved telescopes in 1781. AD. After observing it for some 50 years, some astronomers reached the conclusion that its orbit revealed the influence of yet another planet. Because of an effect on the orbit that suggested a gravitational pull in a certain direction, guided by such mathematical calculations, the missing planet named Neptune was pinpointed by astronomers in 1846. Then, to the end of the 19th century, it became evident that Neptune itself was being subjected to unknown gravitational pull. Was there yet another planet in our solar system? The puzzle was solved in 1930, the year after I was born, with the observation and location of Pluto. The year I was born, they didn't know Pluto existed. Thus, up to 1780, and for centuries before that, people believed there were seven members of our solar system. The Sun, the Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. Earth was not counted because it was believed that these other celestial bodies circle the Earth. Up to 1780. Circle the Earth, the most important celestial body created by God, obviously, with God's most important creation, man, on it. Thus, when I was born, the world, modern world, did not know that Pluto existed. That discovery was made in 1930. All those years since the pyramid was built passed before we could discover Pluto. Up to 1780, and for centuries before that, people believed there were seven members of our solar system. Sun, Moon, Mercury, Venus, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn. I'm reading from The 12th Planet of Zachariah Sitkin. one of three of his books called The Earth Chronicles. The Earth was not counted as a planet because it was believed that these other celestial bodies circled Earth. Obviously, the most important celestial body created by God, with God's most important creation, man, placed thereon. Our textbooks generally credit Nicholas Copernicus with the discovery that Earth is only one of several planets in a heliocentric or sun-centered, not Earth-centered, system. Fearing the wrath of the Christian Church, those who have continued to close the minds in the name of God and thus degrade God's purposes in giving us revelation. Fearing the wrath of the Christian Church for challenging Earth's central position, Copernicus published his study only when on his deathbed in 1543. Spurred to re-examine centuries-old astronomical concepts primarily by the navigational needs, turn me up a little, of the Age of Discovery, and by the findings of Columbus, Magellan, and others that Earth was not flat but spherical, Copernicus depended on mathematical calculations and searched for the answers in ancient writings, no less. One of the few churchmen who supported Copernicus, Cardinal Schoenberg, wrote to him in 1536, quote, "I have learned that you know not only the groundwork of the ancient mathematical doctrines, but that you have created a new theory, according to which the earth is in motion and it is the sun, which occupies the fundamental and therefore the cardinal position," end quote. The concepts then held were based on Greek and Roman traditions that Earth, which was flat, was, quote, "vaulted over," end quote, by the distant heavens in which the stars were fixed. Against the star-studded heavens, the planets, from the Greek word for wanderer, moved around the earth. There were thus seven celestial bodies from which the 7 days of the week and their names originated. The sun, Sunday, moon, Monday, Mars, Mardi, in the French, Mercury, Mercredi, Jupiter, Judy, Venus, Vendredi, and Saturn, Saturday. These astronomical notions stem from the work and codifications of Ptolemy, an astronomer in the city of Alexandria, Egypt, in the 2nd century A.D. His definite findings were that the sun, moon, and five planets moved in circles around the earth. Ptolemaic astronomy predominated for more than 1,300 years until Copernicus put the sun in the center. Well, we've been a smart bunch during the Common Era. While some have called Copernicus the father of modern astronomy, others view him more as a researcher and reconstructor of earlier ideas. The fact is that he pored over the writings of Greek astronomers who preceded Ptolemy, such as Hipparchus and Aristarchus of Samos. The latter, Aristarchus, suggested in the 3rd century B.C. that the motions of the heavenly bodies could better be explained if the sun and not the earth were assumed to be in the center. In fact, 2,000 years before Copernicus, Greek astronomers listed the planets in their correct order from the sun, acknowledging thereby that the sun, not the earth, was the solar system's focal point. The heliocentric, sun-centered concept was only rediscovered by Copernicus. And the interesting fact is that astronomers knew more in 500 BC than in 500 AD and 1500 AD. So much for the traditions. Indeed, scholars are now hard put to explain why first the later Greeks and then the Romans assumed that Earth was flat, rising above a layer of murky waters below, which there lay Hades or hell, when some of the evidence left by Greek astronomers from earlier times indicates that they knew otherwise. Hipparchus, who lived in Asia Minor in the 2nd century B.C., discussed, quote, the displacement of the solstitial and equinoctial sign, the phenomenon now called precession of the equinoxes. But that phenomenon can be explained only in terms of a spherical astronomy, whereby Earth is surrounded by the other celestial bodies as a sphere within a spherical universe. Did Hipparchus then know that Earth was a globe? And did he make his calculations in terms of a spherical astronomy? Equally important is yet another question. Now, what am I seeking to demonstrate? That the traditional idea that man started out pretty limited in intelligence and progressively got smarter to the present day is simply wrong. The Bible indicates there were some smart ones. To whom God revealed things that knew more than the present discoverers in science. No. Did Hipparchus then know that Earth was a globe, and did he make his calculation in terms of a spherical astronomy? Equally important is yet another question. The phenomenon of the precession could be observed by relating the arrival of spring to the sun's position as seen from Earth in a given zodiacal constellation. But the shift from one zodiacal house should go in the precession of equinoxes. From one zodiacal house to another requires 2,160 years, or 2,000 approximately, I'd say. Hipparchus certainly could not have lived long enough to make that 2,160-year astronomical observation. Where, then, did he obtain his information? He was obviously smarter in his knowledge of the heavens than Ptolemy, and the concept that prevailed from Ptolemy through the 1500s, the 16th century. And as we're going to see, he got it from more ancient sources than himself. Too hot now, Mike. Where did he obtain his information? Am I boring you? Eudoxus of Cnidus, another Greek mathematician, an astronomer who lived in Asia Minor 2 centuries before Hipparchus, designed a celestial sphere, a copy of which was set up in Rome as a statue of Atlas supporting the world. The designs on the sphere represent the zodiacal constellations. But if Eudoxus, living 2 centuries before Hipparchus, that takes us back to 700 B.C., conceived the heavens as a sphere, where in relation to the heavens was Earth? Did he think that the celestial globe rested on a flat Earth? A rather awkward arrangement. Or did he know of a spherical Earth enveloped by a celestial sphere. And over here, this is a figure that shows the design of Atlas holding a sphere which had a zodiac around it. Where was Earth? Inside the sphere? Encased by a spherical heavens? Or did he envision a flat Earth with this sphere sitting on it like a soccer ball? The works of Eudoxus, lost in their originals, have come down to us thanks to the poems of Herodotus, who in the 3rd century B.C. translated the facts put forth by the astronomer into poetic language. In this poem, which was familiar to St. Paul because he quoted it. Of course, fundamentalists don't want to have to recognize how widely read and informed the Apostle Paul was. Neither did the early church, who wanted to rest the church on the ignorant foundation of James. And John, the one-syllable man, in the beginning, as an exception, was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among, there's the second two-syllable word, us. Paul quoted from it, and in this poem the constellations are described in great detail, quote, drawn all around, and their groupings and naming is ascribed to a very remote prior age. Quote, some men of yore a nomenclature thought of and devised, and appropriate forms found, end quote. Who were these, quote, men of yore, to whom Eudoxus attributed the designation of the constellations? Based on certain clues in the poem. You don't care?
Yes, sir.
We're going to try to trace back to the source of all this smartness, which is a smartness that could build the pyramid, and which Josephus says placed a similar time capsule intended to survive fire, a brick monument in Mesopotamia. So if Josephus is right that the descendants of Seth, with the prophecy of Adam, built these two time capsules to preserve knowledge through a holocaust, one of stone that's in Egypt to his day, and one of brick that was no longer in Mesopotamia, then those descendants of Seth, those builders of the pyramid, were in both places. Which one was built first? The one in Mesopotamia that no longer was around in Josephus' day? Or the one in Egypt that was still around in Josephus' day and is still around in our day? Who were the, quote, men of yore to whom Eudoxus attributed the designation of the constellations? Based on certain clues in the poem, modern astronomers believe that the Greek verses describe the heavens as they were observed in Mesopotamia around 2200 BC. Now that puts us back another 1500 years. The fact that both Hipparchus and Eudoxus lived in Asia Minor raises the probability that they drew their knowledge from Hittite sources. We didn't even know the Hittite kingdom existed until recently the digs uncovered that amazing Hittite kingdom hints of the existence of which were almost as hard to detect as the gravitational pull that enabled the detection of Pluto in the heavens. And they still have not completely diagnosed the finds of the great Hittite kingdom as a crescendo of archaeological finds, Dead Sea Scrolls, Ebla, El Armana correspondence that we were leading up to last night and didn't get to, that Velikovsky has analyzed in relation to the story of the Exodus. The Hammadi finds of the Gnostic scripture. It is believed that Hipparchus and Eudoxus drew their knowledge from Hittite sources. Perhaps they even visited the Hittite capital and viewed the divine procession carved on the rocks there. For among the marching gods uncovered in the Hittite finds, two bull men hold up a globe. A sight that might well have inspired Eudoxus to sculpt Atlas and the celestial sphere. Give me a picture. See the two men holding up the globe? Were the earlier Greek astronomers living in Asia Minor better informed than their successors because they could draw on Mesopotamian sources? Hipparchus, in fact, confirmed in his writings that his studies were based on knowledge accumulated and verified over many millennia, many thousands of years. He named his mentors, quote, Babylonian astronomers of Erech, Borsippa, and Babylon. Geminus of Rhodes named the Chaldeans, ancient Babylonians, or Babylonians, as the discoverers of the exact motions of the moon. The historian Diodorus Siculus, writing in the 1st century B.C., confirmed the exactness of Mesopotamian astronomy. He stated, quote, the Chaldeans named the planets. In the center of their system was the sun, the greatest light, of which the planets were offspring reflecting the sun's position and shine, end quote. The acknowledged source of Greek astronomical knowledge, then, specifically named by Hipparchus, was Chaldea. Invariably, these earlier Chaldeans possessed greater and more accurate knowledge than the people that followed them. For generations throughout the ancient world, the name Chaldean was synonymous with stargazers, astronomers. I remember Paul in Romans 1 says that man is without excuse because the judgment of God against ungodliness, he says, past tense, was revealed in the heavens. But man without excuse began to worship the creation instead of the Creator and reduced that wonderful message down to animal nature and begin to worship the creation instead of the Creator. By the time the Chaldeans took the knowledge that was ancient even to them and accurate in its astronomical detail, they had already begun to worship the animal signs they used to portray the zodiac. They worshiped the bull instead of the Creator of that which Taurus the bull, or that by which Taurus was symbolized, the bull. The knowledge then, astronomically, is traced to Chaldea in Mesopotamia, But it predated them. It's gone. Abraham, who came out of Ur of the Chaldeans, was told by God, "Oh, you don't care about any of this. I know. Most people listen to me, they get convinced there's a prophetic message in the pyramid and they aren't interested in anything except when's the Lord going to come? Don't trouble me with all the details in between. But you that are interested in me pursuing this line of teaching, which once again will demonstrate the accuracy of God's word and the control of God on history, and the role of the Creator at the beginning and his priestly line, you get on telephone. You talk while the music plays. I'll teach when the music stops." I'm reading from the Chronology of Books, Earth Chronicles. This is Book 1, The 12th Planet. You that have been listening to me teach, you'll remember it was from the second of the series, Stairway to Heaven, that the evidence was offered of Colonel Weiss' forgery in the pyramid of the cartouche of Khufu, or Cheops. And the third is the wars of gods and men. He has some pretty far-out theories, and I don't embrace all of his theories, but his research is pretty impeccable. And I'm reading a section from the 12th Planet on the superior knowledge of astronomy in the ancient world. Compiling and analyzing hundreds of texts from the first millennium B.C., R.C. Thompson, in the book entitled The Reports, or his product, The Reports of the Magicians and Astrologers of Nineveh and Babylon, which couldn't have happened until archaeology burst like an avalanche on the modern world with all of its finds, the Rosetta Stone, and the breaking of hieroglyphics, Linear A and Linear B, out of the product of the work of Evans on Crete, the translations of the Behustin Stone by Professor Rawlinson, and the cracking of many of those ancient, both hieroglyphic and Syriatic writings, have enabled a vast amount of information to be accumulated. R.C. Thompson, analyzing hundreds of texts from the first millennium B.C., was able to show that these stargazers were concerned with the fortunes of the land, its people, and its ruler, from a national point of view and not with individual fortunes derived from the study of the stars. They tended to drift from astronomy into astrology, and that has continued to the present day. But even this astrology required comprehensive and accurate astronomical knowledge, without which no astrological omens were possible to derive. The Mesopotamians, possessing such knowledge, distinguished between the fixed stars and the planets that wandered about. And they knew that the sun and the moon were neither fixed stars nor ordinary planets. They were familiar with comets, meteors, and other celestial phenomena, and could calculate the relationship between the movements of the sun, moon, and earth, and predict eclipses. They followed the motions of the celestial bodies and related them to earth's orbit and rotation through the heliacal system, with the sun in the center, not the earth. And this system, still in use today, measures the rising and setting of stars and planets in Earth's skies relative to the sun. To keep track of the movements of the celestial bodies and their positions in the heavens relative to Earth and to one another, the Babylonians and Assyrians kept accurate tables that listed and predicted the future positions of celestial bodies. Professor George Sarton, in Chaldean astronomy of the last 3 centuries B.C., found that they were computed by 2 methods. These tables predicting future positions of celestial bodies. A later one used in Babylon, an older one, and that's what we're trying to do, push back. And they get smarter, not dumber. An older one from Uruk. This is the gestalt of everything that I'm teaching tonight. His unexpected finding was that the older Uruk method was more sophisticated and more accurate than the later system. As though man deteriorated and moved away from the superior source of knowledge. That's what we've been pushing. 3rd century B.C., the Greeks more accurate. Then the period from Ptolemy in the 2nd century A.D. to 1500. Then from Copernicus onward, who researched ancient astronomers, the knowledge has progressed to the current space probes. But as you go back in time, 300 B.C., they had a better, more accurate view than 2 A.D. You go back to Mesopotamia, 2200 B.C., more accurate than 300 B.C. And now, Uruk, older than Babylon, more sophisticated and more accurate than the later Babylonian system. Professor George Sarton accounted for this surprising situation by concluding that the erroneous astronomical notions of the Greeks and Romans resulted from a shift to a philosophy that explained the world in geometric terms, while the astronomer priests of Chaldea followed the prescribed formulas and traditions of summer. Now we're way back to the Sumerians, maybe the most ancient of cultures yet unearthed. The unearthing of the Mesopotamian civilizations in the past 100 years leaves no doubt that in the field of astronomy, as in so many others, the roots of our knowledge lie deep in Mesopotamia, particularly in the heritage of summer. Now, I don't mean summer, 4th of July. I mean the Sumerians. Sarton's conclusions have been reinforced by very comprehensive studies by Professor O. Neugebauer in his Astronomical Cuneiform Texts. Professor Neugebauer was astonished to find that the ephemerides, the tablets or tables that predicted the future positions of celestial bodies, precise as they were not based on observations by the Babylonian astronomers who prepared them. Instead, they were calculated, quote, from some fixed arithmetical schemes which were given and were not to be interfered with by the astronomers who used them. A knowledge passed on, arithmetical. Such automatic adherence to, quote, arithmetical schemes, end quote, was achieved with the aid of, quote, procedural texts that accompanied the ephemerides, which gave the rules for computing them step by step according to some strict mathematical theory. Neugebauer concluded that the Babylonian astronomers were ignorant of the theories on which the tables predicting future positions of the celestial bodies and their mathematical calculations were based. They had a plan for predicting it passed on to them. He also admitted that, quote, the empirical and theoretical foundation of these accurate tables to a large extent escapes modern scholars as well. Yet he is convinced that ancient astronomical theories... Go up and direct and get Joe down here, see if he can straighten his sound out. Yet he is convinced that ancient astronomical theories, quote, must have existed prior to the Mesopotamians, because it is impossible to devise computational schemes of high complication without a very elaborate plan, all of which reduces down to they had a mathematical formula for devising these schemes, just like you can learn to use a slide rule without understanding all the theories behind it. You might not be able to build a slide rule, but you can learn how to use one. They had the plan not to be deviated from to work out the predictions, but they got it from an earlier source. Professor Alfred Jeremias concluded in his handbook in German that the Mesopotamian astronomers were acquainted with the phenomenon of retrograde. What's retrograde? The apparent erratic and snake-like course of the planets as seen from the Earth, caused by the fact that the Earth orbits the Sun either faster or slower than the other planets. Thus, the other planets are seen, due to this, in an apparent erratic course. The significance of such knowledge lies not only in the fact that retrograde is a phenomenon related to orbits around the Sun, but also the significance is in the fact that very long periods of observation were required to grasp and track the retrograde path. Where were these complicated theories developed? And who made the observations without which they could not have been developed? Neugebauer pointed out that, quote, in the procedure texts, we meet a great number of technical terms of wholly unknown reading, if not unknown meaning. Someone much earlier than the Babylonians possessed astronomical and mathematical knowledge far superior to that of later culture in Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, Greece, and Rome. Somebody that had a knowledge that enabled them to build the pyramid. Who?
Who?
The Babylonians and Assyrians devoted a substantial part of their astronomical efforts to keeping an accurate calendar, like the Jewish calendar. To this very day, it was a solar lunar calendar correlating or intercalating the solar year of just over 365 days with a lunar month of just under 30 days. The solar year, which our calendars are based on, and the lunar calendar. To measure and correlate the intricate movements of sun, earth, moon, and planets, the Mesopotamian astronomer priest relied on a complex spherical astronomy. Earth was taken to be a sphere with an equator and poles. The heavens, too, were divided by imaginary equatorial and polar lines. The passage of celestial bodies was related to the ecliptic. The projection of the plane of the Earth's orbit around the Sun upon the celestial sphere, the equinoxes, the points and the times at which the Sun in its apparent annual movement north and south crosses the celestial equator, and the solstices, the time when the Sun during its apparent annual movement along the ecliptic is at its greatest declination north or south. All these are astronomical concepts used to this very day, but rather modern, and built into the pyramid. These ancient Mesopotamian astronomer priests were able to calculate all of this from a formula that they didn't necessarily understand, but by rote could do, because it came from an earlier source. Another way of saying, the Babylonians and Assyrians did not invent the calendar or the ingenious means for its calculation. Their calendars, as well as our own, originated in summer among the Sumerians. There the scholars have found a calendar in use from the very earliest times that is the basis for all later calendars. That principal calendar and model was the calendar of Nippur, the seat and center of Enlil. Our present-day one is modeled on that Nippurian calendar. Based on that, the Sumerians considered the new year to begin at the exact moment when the sun crossed the spring equinox. That isn't any time to start the year. Well, before you start challenging these Sumerians, remember God said, these are the set times of the Lord, the feast days, the feasts of the Lord, literally the set times of the Lord. And he starts with the Sabbath, and then the first day of the month, the religious month, Passover. Is that in the spring or not? Now, we begin January through the heathen corruption of the worship of Tammuz, a later addition. But in ancient summer, the Sumerians considered the new year to begin at the exact moment when the sun crossed the spring equinox. Professor Stephen Langdon, in tablets from the archives of Dreham, found that records left by Dungi, a ruler of Ur about 2400 BC, show that the Nippurian calendar selected a certain celestial body by whose setting against the sunset it was possible to determine the exact moment of the New Year's arrival. This, he concluded, was done perhaps 2,000 years before the era of Dungi. That is about 4400 BC. Now we're way back there, when man was crawling out of a cave. Can it really be that the Sumerians, without actual instruments, nevertheless had the sophisticated astronomical and mathematical know-how required by a spherical astronomy and geometry? Indeed, they had, as their language shows. They had a term, dub, D-U-B, that meant in astronomy the 360-degree circumference of the world, in relation to which they spoke of the curvature or arc of the heavens. You say, what has God to do with me? Well, the Bible's got something to do with you. And all this is supporting the biblical position. There were some smart people who lived before the flood. Not only were they smart, we're dumb by comparison. But if we take our dumbness and live 900 years, man, I'm so much smarter than I was when I came here 10 years ago. I'm so much smarter now than I was when I got my PhD at Stanford in 1957. What a crime that youth is wasted on youth. I like George Burns' song. I wish he was 18 again. Do we know how smart we'd be if we could live building on the knowledge we now have 900 years? And let's just go back to Seth. Our father, for how long we don't know, was privately tutored by God. Well, you know, I read that, but I never really expected to believe that in the Bible. Well, what do you think the book of Genesis means? Beginnings. These Sumerians had a term, dub. Now, that doesn't mean just because you're dubbing tapes out there, you're suddenly smarter. I want my engineers to get that. That meant in astronomy, the 360-degree circumference of the world, in relation to which they spoke of the curvature or arc of the heavens. For their astronomical and mathematical calculations, they drew the An-Ur, capital A-N, capital U-R, an imagined heavenly horizon against which they could measure the rising and setting of celestial bodies. Perpendicular to this horizon, they extended an imagined vertical line, the Nu-Bu-Sar-Da. Spell it just like it sounds. With its aid, they obtained the zenith point and called it the An-Pa. They traced the lines we call meridians and called them the graded yokes. Latitude lines were called middle lines of heaven. The latitude line marking the summer solstice, for example, was called Anbil, translated fiery point of the heavens. The Akkadian, the fair-skinned conquerors of summer, called the black-headed ones, Hurrian, Hittite, and other literary masterpieces of the ancient Near East, being translations or versions of Sumerian originals, were replete with Sumerian loanwords pertaining to celestial bodies and phenomena, cognates. Babylonian and Assyrian scholars, am I boring you? Babylonian and Assyrian scholars who drew up star lists and wrote down calculations of planetary movements often noted the Sumerian originals on the tablets that they were copying or translating. The 25,000 texts devoted to astronomy and astrology, said to have been included in the Nineveh Library of Ashurbanipal, frequently bore acknowledgement of Sumerian origins. 25,000. Until the 1800s, and lawyer dug at Nineveh, we had no idea of this. The basic thought I am seeking to drive home is that man has not gotten progressively smarter from a very primitive Stone Age beginning. But man began with a source of knowledge, certainly a knowledge revealing a wisdom and knowledge that steadily deteriorated through the Middle Ages, until it has now started to turn around. And we were tracing the knowledge of mathematics and astronomy back past Ptolemy, beginning with the realization that Pluto was not discovered in our universe as an additional planet until 1930. And pushing back, where'd Joe go? Go get on the sound. And pushing back to the 2nd century A.D., we find that from Ptolemy in the 2nd century A.D. to Greek astronomers 300 B.C., the more ancient of those two had a superior knowledge. Their knowledge went back through Hittite and Babylonian sources, ultimately to the ancient Sumerian and the Nippurian calendar, which takes us behind even the Babylonians and ancient Mesopotamian valleys. The 25,000 texts devoted to astronomy and astrologers said to have been included in the Nineveh library of Ashurbanipal frequently bore acknowledgments of Sumerian origins. A major astronomical series that the Babylonians called, quote, the Day of the Lord, was declared by its scribes to have been copied from a Sumerian tablet written in the time of Sargon of Akkad in the 3rd millennium B.C., the conqueror of the Sumerians, Sargon the Great. A tablet dated to the 3rd dynasty of Ur, also in the 3rd millennium B.C., describes and lists a series of celestial bodies. You're getting better, but it isn't right yet. Now, I need to tell you, you hear a different sound out there on TV than those in this studio. Now, I've been battling the in-studio sound all evening. A tablet dated to the... And we're trying to fix it. A tablet dated to the 3rd dynasty of Ur, also in the 3rd millennium B.C., describes and lists a series of celestial bodies so clearly that modern scholars had little difficulty in recognizing the text as a classification of constellations, among them Ursa Major, Draco, Lyra, Cygnus, and Cepheus, Triangulum in the northern skies, Orion, Canis Major, Hydra, Corvus, and Centaurus in the southern skies, and the familiar zodiacal constellations in the central celestial band. I just made it worse. You got to distinguish between talking to you and talking to my engineer working on the sound. In ancient Mesopotamia, the secrets of celestial knowledge were guarded, studied, and transmitted by astronomer priests. It was thus perhaps fitting that three scholars who are credited with giving back to us this lost Chaldean science were Jesuit priests: Joseph Epping, Johann Strassmann, and Franz Kugler. Kugler, in a masterwork, analyzed, deciphered, sorted out, and explained a vast number of texts and lists, and in one instance, by mathematically, quote, turning the skies backwards, he was able to show that a list of 33 celestial bodies in the Babylonian skies of 1800 B.C. was neatly arranged according to present-day groupings of those same phenomena. So they were pretty smart, those people. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
This studio's killing me. Should have went home.
No, sir.
Too cold again. The sound is lousy. You better stay awake. I'm getting more crotchety by the moment. My cigar won't even burn in here. After much work deciding which are the true groups and which are merely subgroups, the world's astronomical community agreed in 1925 to divide the heavens as seen from Earth into three regions. This is modern genius at work. To divide the heavens as seen from Earth into three regions, northern, central, and southern, and group the stars therein into 88 constellations. As it turned out, there was nothing new in this arrangement, for the Sumerians were the first to divide the heavens into three bands, or what they call ways, The northern way was named after Enlil. The southern way was named after Ea. And the central band was the way of Anu. And the Sumerians assigned each of these three ways various constellations. The present-day central band, the band of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, corresponds exactly to the way of Anu, in which the Sumerians grouped the stars into 12 houses those many, many millenniums ago. In antiquity as today, the phenomenon was related to the concept of the zodiac. The great circle of earth around the sun was divided into 12 equal parts of 30 degrees each. The stars seen in each of these segments or houses were grouped together into a constellation, each of which was then named according to the shape the stars of the group seemed to form. Because the constellations and their subdivisions and even individual stars within the constellations have reached Western civilization with names and descriptions borrowed heavily from Greek mythology, the Western world tended for nearly two millennia to credit the Greeks with this achievement. But it is now apparent that the early Greek astronomers merely adopted into their language and mythology a ready-made astronomy obtained from the Sumerians. We have already noted how Hipparchus, Eudoxus, and others obtained their knowledge. Even Thales, the earliest Greek astronomer of consequence, who is said to have predicted the total solar eclipse of May 28, 585 BC, which stopped the war between the Lydians and the Medians, allowed the sources of his knowledge that enabled him to do that were of pre-Semitic Mesopotamian origins, namely Sumerian. We have acquired the name Zodiac. You're getting close. Just stop it there for a while. We have acquired the name Zodiac from the Greek Zodiacos Kyklos, which translates animal circle. Zodiacos Kyklos, animal circle. Because the layout of the star groups was likened to the shape of a lion, fishes, bull, so on. But those imaginary shapes and names were actually originated by the Sumerians, or earlier. At least, we can trace them back to the Sumerians, who called the 12 zodiacal constellations Uli, shiny herd. One was Gu-Anna, heavenly bull, Taurus. Try this on your companion when they give you trouble. Number two was Mashtaba, translates twins, our Gemini, as the heavenly bull was our Taurus. Dub, which translates alternately pincers or tongs, our crab or cancer. Ergula translates lion, which we call Leo. Abscene, which means her father was Sin, translates the maiden of Virgo. Zibaana, heavenly fate, for the scales of Libra. Gertab, which translates which cuts and claws, our Scorpio. The eighth one was Pabil, meaning defender, our archer or Sagittarius. Number nine was Suhermash, which translates goldfish, or Capricorn. Number 10, Gu, Lord of the Waters. Our words are the water bearer or Aquarius. Number 11 was Sim-Ma, or fishes, our Pisces. Number 12 was Kumal, for field dweller, our Ram, or Aries. So the Greeks didn't originate anything in that regard. The pictorial representation or signs of the zodiac, like their names, have remained virtually intact since their introduction in summer. Some changes, as we pointed out when we studied on God's message in the stars. I don't need to show you the figures of those various pictorial representations. And it is the accusation of Romans 1 from the mouth of Paul that man began to worship those images and the creature instead of the Creator. Until the introduction of the telescope, European astronomers accepted Ptolemaic recognition of only 19 constellations in the northern skies. By 1925, when the current classification was agreed upon, 28 constellations had been recognized in what the Sumerians called the Way of Enlil. We should no longer be surprised to find out that, unlike Ptolemy, the earlier Sumerians recognized, identified, grouped, named, and listed all the constellations of the northern skies. Didn't miss one. Of the celestial bodies in the Way of Enlil, 12 were deemed to be of Enlil, paralleling the 12 zodiacal celestial bodies in the Way of Anu, likewise in the southern portion of the skies. Enlil, the northern portion, Ea, the southern portion, Anu, the central equatorial portion. In the southern portion of the skies, the Way of Ea, 12 constellations were listed, not merely as present in the southern skies, but as of the god Ea. In addition to these 12 principal constellations of Ea, several others were listed for the southern skies, though not so many as are recognized today. The Way of Ea, the southern skies, posed serious problems to the Assyriologists who undertook the immense task of unraveling the ancient astronomical knowledge, not only in terms of modern knowledge, but also based on what the sky should have looked like centuries or millennia ago. Observing the southern skies from Ur or Babylon, the Mesopotamian astronomer could see only a little more than halfway into the southern skies. The rest was already below the horizon. Yet, if correctly identified, some of the constellations of the Way of Ea, the southern way, lay well below the horizon. But there was an even greater problem. If, as the scholars assume, the Mesopotamians believed, as the Greeks did in later times, that Earth was a mass of dry land resting upon the chaotic darkness of a nether world, the Greek Hades, a flat disk over which the heavens arched in a semicircle, then they shouldn't have had any constellations in the southern skies at all. Your proof, therefore, they had the spherical concept, the right one. Restricted by the assumption that the Mesopotamians were beholden to a flat earth concept, which much of earlier scholarship held, modern scholars could not permit their conclusions to take them too much below the equatorial line dividing north and south. The evidence, however, shows that the three Sumerian ways encompass the complete skies of a global, not a flat earth. In 1900, T.G. Pinches reported to the Royal Asiatic Society that he was able to reassemble and reconstruct a complete Mesopotamian astrolabe, literally taker of stars. He showed it to be a circular disk divided like a pie into 12 segments and three concentric rings resulting in a field of 36 portions. The whole design had the appearance of a rosette of 12 leaves, each of which had the name of a month written in it. Pinches remarked, or rather marked them, 1 to 12 for convenience, starting with Nisanu, the first month of the Mesopotamian calendar. I'm not going to show you that figure. It's too complicated. Each of the 36 portions also contained a name with a small circle below it, signifying that it was the name of a celestial body. The names have since been found in many texts and star lists and are undoubtedly the names of constellations, stars, or planets. Each of the 36 segments also had a number written below the name of the celestial body. In the innermost ring, the numbers range from 30 to 60, in the central ring from 60 to 120, and in the outermost ring from 120 to 240. What did these numbers represent? Writing nearly 50 years after the presentation of Apicius, the astronomer and Assyriologist O. Neugebauer, in A History of Ancient Astronomy, Problems and Methods, could only say that the whole text constitutes some kind of schematic celestial map. Come over here, I'm going to let you take a picture of it. In each of the 36 fields, we find the name of a constellation and simple numbers whose significance is not yet clear to this scholar and Assyriologist. A leading expert, that's why I'm going to show it to you, such fine print, we can't pick it up. But that's the chart that if you could look close at the detail, you would begin to see. And those are the little 12 circles right here in the middle. In 1900, T.G. Pinches reported the Royal Asiatic Society that he was able to reassemble and reconstruct a complete Mesopotamian astrolabe. There's a picture of it reproduced here that I showed you quickly. And yet, writing nearly 50 years after the presentation of Apicius, the astronomer and Assyriologist O. Neugebauer, in A History of Ancient Astronomy, Problems and Methods, could only say that this ancient astrolabe construction and the text that was on it constitutes some kind of schematic celestial map produced by these ancient Mesopotamians. In each of the 36 fields, he says, we find the name of a constellation and simple numbers whose significance is not yet clear. Now, if the Assyriologist can't understand it yet, go out in here, Mike. Then I'm sure we can't. But the point is, they had a knowledge far in excess of the movements of the heavenly bodies than the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, or modern history in relationship to ancient times from 200 B.C. or rather A.D. to the 1500s. The puzzle of this ancient astrolabe can only be solved if one discards the notion that the Mesopotamians believed in the flat earth, and which is what tradition has said. And it can only be resolved if one recognizes that the Mesopotamian astronomical knowledge was as good as ours. Not because they had better instruments than we do, but because they had a source of information that gave it to them. And that source didn't necessarily need better instruments than we have. In this astrolabe complicated diagram put together by the Assyriologists, the enigmatic numbers represent degrees of the celestial arc with the North Pole as the starting point. And the astrolabe was a planisphere, which is nothing other than the representation of a sphere on a flat surface. While the numbers increase and decrease, those in the opposite segments for the way of Enlil add up to 90. All those for the way of Anu add up to 180, and all those for the way of Ea add up to 360. These figures are too familiar to be misunderstood. They represent the segments of a complete spherical circumference, a quarter of the way, 90 degrees, halfway, 180 degrees, full circle, 360. The numbers given, the numbers in each of these areas, the numbers given for the way of Enlil are so paired as to show that this Sumerian segment of the northern skies stretched over 60 degrees from the North Pole, bordering on the way of Anu at 30 degrees above the equator. The way of Anu was equidistant on both sides of the equator, reaching the 30 degrees south below the equator. Then further south and farthest away from the North Pole lay the way of Ea, that part of Earth and of the celestial globe that lay between 30 degrees south and the South Pole. The numbers of the way of Ea segments add up to 180 degrees in Adaru, February to March, and Ululu, August to September. The only point that is 180 degrees away from the North Pole, whether you go south on the east or on the west, is the South Pole. And this holds true only if one deals with a sphere. So without remembering the details, the diagram simply was a flat representation of a sphere. The way of Anu, the celestial band of the sun, planets and constellations of the zodiac, look at this diagram, lay along the equatorial band. The way of Enlil, in the northern skies, the way of Ea, in the southern skies, as you stood on this globe and looked at the sphere of the heavens. Now, precession of the equinoxes is the phenomenon caused by the wobble of the Earth's north-south axes, causing the North Pole, the one pointing at the North Star, and the South Pole to trace a grand circle in the heavens. The apparent retardation of Earth against the starry constellations amounts to about 50 seconds of an arc in 1 year, or 1 degree in 72 years. The grand circle, the time it takes the Earth's North Pole to point again at the same North Star, lasts 25,920 years, or 72 times 360. A little oversimplification because it varies, but it's in the neighborhood of 26,000 years. And that is what the astronomers call the great year of the Plutonian year, for apparently Plato too was aware of the phenomenon. The ring and setting of various stars deemed significant in antiquity, and the precise determination of the spring equinox, which ushered in the new year, were related to the zodiacal house in which they occurred. Due to the precession, a phenomenon related to the wobble of the Earth on its axis while it spins and goes around the sun, and the different pointing of the extension of the pole from south to north pole into the heavens. Every 2,000 years on its wobble, it points to a different star. And the rising and setting of various stars and the precise determination of the spring equinox were related to the zodiacal house in which they occurred. Due to precession, the precession of the equinoxes, the spring equinox and other celestial phenomena, being retarded from year to year, were finally retarded once in 2,160 years, or accurately approximately 2,000 years, by a full zodiacal house. Our astronomers continue to employ a zero point, the first point of Aries, which marked the spring equinox in 900 BC. But this point has by now shifted well into the house of Pisces. AD 2100, the spring equinox will begin to occur in the preceding house of Aquarius. This is what is meant by those who say we are about to enter the age of Aquarius. And the North Star will change when we move into the 2,000-year period of Aquarius. Pretty smart people, weren't they? To be able to map those things when our modern television-educated audience just about gets lost even talking about it. Except for my audience. Because the shift from one zodiacal house to another takes more than 2,000 years, scholars wondered how and where Hipparchus could have learned of the precession of the 2nd century B.C. It is now clear that his source was Sumerian. Professor Langdon's findings reveal that the Nepurian calendar, established about 4,400 B.C. in the age of Taurus, reflects knowledge of the precession and the shift of zodiacal houses that took place 2,160 years earlier than that. As the builders of the pyramid could predict in the precession of the equinoxes the exact date that would line up Alcyone and the Pleiades and Alpha Draconis and the dragon constellation to give the benchmark of the dates and the prophetic plan in the pyramid. Somebody was awful smart. Professor Jeremias, who correlated Mesopotamian astronomical texts with Hittite astronomical texts, was also of the opinion that older astronomical tablets recorded the change from Taurus to Aries. And he concluded that the Mesopotamian astronomers predicted and anticipated the shift from Aries to Pisces. Subscribing to these conclusions, Professor Wiley Hartner, in The Earliest History of the Constellations in the Near East, suggested that the Sumerians, you're killing me with this mic, suggest get the base out of it. Take it all out. I mean, I've been fighting and I've been telling you it's in the mix. Don't touch any button but the mix. You get the base out of this thing and I might be able to talk. Or find me another machine that the battery isn't about out of. That had nothing to do with you. God, I wish I had a Sumerian here to fix my microphone. Professor Wiley Hartner suggested that the Sumerians left behind plentiful. Did you make them put their hands in their pocket when I told you to leave it there about an hour ago? You sure? They've been playing around with some buttons. Subscribing to these conclusions, Professor Wiley Hartner suggested that the Sumerians left behind plentiful pictorial evidence to that effect. When the spring equinox was in the zodiac of Taurus, the summer solstice occurred in the zodiac of Leo. Hartner drew attention to the recurrent motive of a bull-lion combat appearing in Sumerian depictions from earliest times, and suggested that these motifs represented the key positions of the constellation of Taurus the bull and Leo the lion to an observer at 30 degrees north, such as at Ur, circa 4000 B.C. Most scholars consider the Sumerian stress of Taurus as their first constellation as evidence not only of the antiquity of the zodiac, dating it to 4000 B.C., because it's gone through two separate constellation houses to the present, but also testifying to the time when Sumerian civilization so suddenly began. Professor Jeremias, in the Old Testament in the Light of the Ancient East, found evidence, you're getting there, showing that the Sumerian, don't touch anything now, leave the buttons alone. Found evidence showing that the Sumerian zodiacal chronological point zero stood precisely between the bull and the twins. From this and other data, he concluded that the zodiac was devised in the age of Gemini, the twins. That is, even before Sumerian civilization began. A Sumerian tablet in the Berlin Museum, VAT 7847, begins the list of zodiacal constellations with that of Leo, taking us back to 11,000 B.C. Professor H.V. Hilprecht, in the Babylonian expedition of the University of Pennsylvania, went even further, studying thousands of tablets bearing mathematical tabulations, he concluded that, quote, all the multiplication and division tables from the temple libraries of Nippur and Sippar and from the library of Ashurbanipal in Nineveh are based upon the number 1,296,000. 12,960,000. Analyzing this number and its significance, he concluded that it could be related only to the phenomenon of the procession, and that the Sumerians knew of the great year of 25,920 years. This is indeed fantastic astronomical sophistication at an impossible time. Just as it is evident that the Sumerian astronomers possessed knowledge that they could not possibly have acquired on their own, so is there evidence to show that a good deal of their knowledge was of no practical use to them. What do they have it for? Like some of them buttons they got up there. No practical use to them. Just as it is evident that the Sumerian astronomers possessed knowledge that they could not possibly have acquired on their own, so is there evidence to show that a good deal of their knowledge was of no practical use to them. The suggestion being, since it was of no practical use, these practitioners, the Sumerians, wouldn't have developed it in their practice. Like scholastic education studied Latin, not because we use Latin, but because predecessors did. This pertains not only to the very sophisticated astronomical methods that were used. Who in ancient summer really needed to establish a celestial equator, for example, out in the heavens? Very important to us, particularly if you're riding in a shot to the moon. You're trying to send a space probe past Uranus. I like it when it gets late. No practical use to that. Who in ancient summer really needed to establish a celestial equator, for example? But also to a variety of elaborate texts that dealt with the measurement of distances between the stars. Why'd they need that? One of these texts, known as AO6478, lists the 26 major stars visible along the line we now call the Tropic of Cancer, and gives distances between them as measured in three different ways. The text first gives the distances between these stars by a unit called mana shukutu, that is, measured and weighed. It is believed that this was an ingenious device that related the weight of escaping water to the passage of time, just as we now use carbon-14 as a dating method. It made possible the determination of distances between two stars in terms of time. Pretty sophisticated measuring devices. The second column of distances was in terms of degrees of the arc of the skies. The full day, daylight, and nighttime were divided into 12 double hours. The arc of the heavens comprised a full circle of 360 degrees. Hence one biru, or double hour, represented 30 degrees of the arc of the heavens. By this method, passage of time on Earth provided a measure of the distances and degrees between the named celestial bodies. Very sophisticated. The third method of measurement they used was Beru Inashami, length in the skies. Ephthorodongan, in his French work, Distances Between Fixed Stars, pointed out that while the first two methods were relative to other phenomena, This third method provided absolute measurements. A celestial Biru, he and others pointed out, was equivalent to 10,692 of our present-day meters, or 11,693 yards. The distance in the skies between the 26 stars was calculated in the text as adding up to 655,200 Biru drawn in the skies. The availability of three different methods of measuring distance between stars conveys the great importance attached to the matter. Yet who among the men and women of summer needed such knowledge? I mean, you know, were they going to play baseball between the stars? Or who among them could devise the methods and accurately use them? The only possible answer is someone else had the knowledge and the need for such accurate measurements. Now, he doesn't say someone else. He has his theory of who. I just skipped over that. I have my theory of who. But we agree. The Sumerians didn't come up with it. They got it from somebody else, or someone else, or something else. Am I boring you?
No, sir.
Against this background of knowledge and measurement of the stars given to them, can it be assumed that the Mesopotamian astronomers, guided by this source of knowledge they had, were not aware of the planets beyond Saturn, that they didn't know of Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto? Was their knowledge of Earth's own family, the solar system, less complete than that of distant stars, their order, and their distances? I'm going to skip ahead real quickly. Here is, over here, real fast. Here. Just get the diagram from here down. Come on, Peter. Here to the bottom. Get them both. Go on, you haven't got all of it, Peter. All of it, up here. There. Now, zoom in on just this one. This is a diagram laid out of the universe as we know it in relative sizes. Sun, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto, Mercury, Venus, Earth with its moon, and Mars. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11. Here is the ancient Sumerian layout. Sun, Jupiter, let's get them both, Peter, if you can. Sun, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune. For some strange reason, Pluto is in a different place between Saturn and Uranus. But it's there. Venus and Mercury, side by side, though in respective sizes the same, whereas here their position a bit different. Earth with its moon and Mars. But there is a 12th planet, smaller than Jupiter, larger than Mars, added. Now, it wasn't until 1930 we discovered Pluto by watching the gravitational pull on Uranus. Now, with the superior knowledge of the Sumerians, what are they doing putting an extra 12th planet in? Kind of reminds me of the Dogon people. They saw an extra body moving, located it, knew its orbit that couldn't be seen. Until modern astronomy discovered the white dwarf. And then they discovered that the Dogon people, who built their entire religious concept in Mali and Central Africa, were right. They didn't gain that knowledge themselves. They inherited it from someone who told them, and they worshipped around. They claimed the fish man came from there and brought them this knowledge. Now, the whole evening was moving toward this point. the superior knowledge of the heavenly bodies exhibited by the Sumerians, who were closer to some original source of knowledge who gave it to them, had a 12th planet there. Now, white dwarfs have been pretty hard to find way out there. You still can't see a black hole, which is a collapsed star or body that has been crushed to such a mass that its gravitational pull will capture light, so you therefore can't see it. What is this 12th planet? Now, he has his theory. Well, you don't care. I mean, have the Sumerians exhibited an accuracy of knowledge at least to give them credence for projecting a 12th planet that's not on our... That's a long time ago. Was there a planet that did exist that doesn't exist now? That was in the cosmogony given and the picture of the heavenly reality given that these people took, per se, from whomever gave it to them? Somebody back there knew something I'd like to know.